It's Hi everybody, this is Joanne, Science Goddess on Twitter, and we are here with my co-host Jeff Schomeyer on Read Science, and our guest today is Dave Levitin. Is that right?
Hello. That's right.
I didn't ask how to say your last name. So we're here with Dave Levitin, who has written a really interesting and timely book called Not a Scientist: How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. And I know there's been a lot of interest in this book as I've been promoting it, because I was interested in it, and every time I would bring it up, people would retweet, and you know, it generate a lot of interest. So first of all, let's do a quick little introduction of David. Jeff, by the way, hi.
Hi, Julie. Hi, David.
Hi, audience.
Hi to both of you. Thank you for having me here.
We're glad you're here. So Dave Levitin is a journalist with a master's degree in journalism from NYU Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program. And your work has appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer, Scientific American, Slate, and many other outlets, as is the case with a lot of our guests. And of course, the author of this book. So welcome. We're glad you're here.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
No. Yeah.
I decided I'd like to start today with getting some broad context so that we know what it is that we're going to be talking about and what's going on. And I was thinking as I was finishing your book that the goals of science and scientists and politics and politicians don't always coincide. This is pretty evident. And as a scientist, I'm not surprised when politicians prevaricate, let's say, about scientific knowledge. Fashions change frequently in politics. We're in a short, I hope, period of fake news these days. But not long ago, I want to read this quotation you had from President Obama in his 2015 State of the Union message, saying, "I've heard some folks try to dodge the evidence by saying they're not scientists, that we don't have enough information to act. Well, I'm not a scientist either, but you know what? I know a lot of really good scientists at NASA and NOAA and at our major universities." So I thought, give us first the backstory about how you came to give this title to your book and what it is that you wanted to accomplish with this.
Sure. The title and the reason for that quote from President Obama came about because a whole lot of politicians had started using this line, you know, "I'm not a scientist." But it's always the "but" that follows it that is the most important part. We started seeing it get used a lot. I think it sort of started in the 2009 to 10 range, and then for a few years following that, almost always about climate change, although I'm sure it could be used for other things. It just sort of infuriated me because it's such a weird talking point. You know, it's the only field or only subject, I guess, where politicians have to tell us that they're not experts on the topic at hand. I mean, they never say that they're not, you know, experts in tax reform or experts in, you know, the Middle East or whatever it is that they're discussing. They just talk about the issue, and we kind of assume or hope, I guess, that they're probably talking to experts at other times who can tell them about this issue. And one would hope that was how it works with science as well. But for some reason, and it's hard to say exactly why, but science seemed to give a lot of politicians license to use this sort of smokescreen, this idea that scientific topics are unknowable, right? That they're the province of nerds off in the corner somewhere, and so it's sort of a way to disavow expertise.
That's it, right there. Yeah, and it was usually part of a deflection, right? I'm no scientist, but here's why scientists are wrong.
Right, right. Yeah, they would always then say something dramatically wrong after that line.
And for decades, science was, what scientists said was pretty much unassailable. And then since at least the days of tobacco litigation and stuff, casting doubt and saying in some way, "I'm not a scientist, but they're wrong," has been the way to go about it, with all these things that you talk about, like, we still don't have all of the results. There's still controversy. All of these things as a way to to push the science to the side of any political debate, right?
Yeah, yeah, no, I think you're right that it's interesting how this shifted, right? I mean, as you said, you know, for a long time, scientists were sort of, I don't want to say godlike, but they were certainly well-trusted. I mean, scientists were considered sort of unassailable. If experts tell you something, you just listen to it. And this is, I mean, there's a lot of reasons for this, but you could tie it into, you know, how the earliest NASA astronauts were kind of rock stars at the time, you know, and there was a sort of veneration for science, which definitely has gone away over the years. I mean, as I described in the intro, the first example of that talking point that I was Ronald Reagan in the TV using that line, "I'm not a scientist." So it does date back a while, but it took a while for that to sort of become more in vogue, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you've given us a lot of practical advice of things to watch for, and what I think Carl Sagan would have called something like our bullshit detector toolbox. And one that sort of like up at the top, a general way that I really liked was very early on in the book, here's a quotation. You say, "Science is hard. When a politician makes it sound easy, look close."
Yeah, so that's you know, just the sort of the most basic of all the types of error or trick that I talk about, just called the oversimplification. Some of the other errors I gave weird names, but that one is certainly familiar. I think that's probably among the most common things we see politicians do, is just boil science down into something that sort of hides the truth of the matter. And I should say it's often very useful to do this well, right? To talk about a complex topic in simple terms so that people who are not experts can understand. It's not like that's a bad thing, but to do it in such a disingenuous way as we see a lot of the time, where they're, you know, using that technique of simplifying something to hide the truth of the matter, to make it seem like the more complicated version is something other than it actually is. So yeah, that it's common, and it's pretty insidious sometimes. And although I should say, sometimes if we're being generous, maybe it's by accident.
You start out by saying you're going to try very hard not to ascribe intent, malintent to these situations, and you do try very hard, but it's awfully hard not to treat some of it as, to see it as malicious, right?
Yeah, no, that's definitely hard. I think my goal for the general book was to not really discuss intent, but some of the types of errors I talk about, it is impossible to do by accident.
That's right.
You just can't. So, and I think I tried to mention that when it does come up. There are some of them that, you know, you basically have to plan to try to mislead people. So.
Yeah.
So actually, why don't we go through some of, so we've got here 12 different types of, I don't know, ways of scientists mess up science, whether it's on purpose or not.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so actually, if people will not mind, I will just go through the 12 very quickly. But then I do want to ask, wow, how did you really just sit there and sort out that there were 12 ways, 12 categories, right? So the first one is oversimplification, which you said. Then the cherry pick, which hopefully anybody in science understands this one very quick. The butter up and undercut. And I like how that rolls off the tongue. But then also it's like, oh yeah, I could see why you do that. The demonizer, the blame the blogger, which we can do these days, the ridicule and dismiss, the literal nitpick, which kids like to do a lot, I think, the credit snatch, the certain uncertainty, the blind eye to follow up, the lost in translation, and the straight up fabrication. So, wow. So how did you, I mean, you must have like observed scientists for, I mean, days and years and weeks, you know, just to go, okay, how are they doing this? And, you know, when was your aha moment of like, I see there's a pattern here. Maybe I should write a book. I'm, you know, curious how this book started and how you divided it up like you did.
Sure. So the idea to do it that way, It arose when, so I'm a freelancer, but I was on staff at factcheck.org in 2015. And so they hired me at the beginning of that year to be their first ever full-time science writer. They had covered science before, but sort of not in a super consistent fashion. And they did not have anyone on staff who was trained as a science writer, but they got a grant specifically to do that, to cover politicians getting science wrong. And so I was the one they hired to do that. And I really, so basically my day job was to just pay attention to what politicians were saying about science. And when they got it wrong, explain why. So as you can imagine, I did not lack for material. And very quickly, I did start to notice some patterns in how they were getting the science wrong. Sometimes it was as simple as repeated talking points. But other times it wasn't the exact same words. It was more just the patterns by which they made their mistakes or purposeful lies, as the case may be. And so I just started collecting them. At first, it was just sort of trying to, the names that I have for all these, some of them came a little bit later, but I more so just had descriptions of the way these patterns were emerging. It really only took a few months of working there before I started to think that this would be a useful thing to sort of collect in one place, to have it as a sort of playbook. That was sort of where the idea came from. By the end of that year, I left that job to go back to freelancing and basically to finish the book and work on that. It was, a little bit of help from my editor at Norton, where it was published, to sort of streamline them. I think I had one extra chapter, which I don't even remember what it was right now, but there were a few times when, I had one that I thought was a good category, but then I realized, well, maybe it sort of overlaps with another category or something like that. So it took a little while to collect them into those 12 and a bonus 13th in the conclusion. That's sort of where it all came from and how I categorized them, I guess.
If you're not paying close attention or listening to politics all the time, and it takes a lot of stamina to listen to politics all the time, it might be easy to imagine that the instances that you cite are just something that slipped out of some politician's mouth. But when you listen a lot, you find out that there are talking points that get spread around, that there are tools that thing. And as you've noticed with this book, and once you draw our attention to it, we notice there was a period we went through where everyone began a sentence by saying, "I'm not a scientist," but there's a lot of amplification of this stuff that goes on. That's kind of a recent phenomenon too, isn't it, with the internet and
absolutely
the way that can get around.
I think you're right. I think politicians always have had big platforms, but certainly they're bigger now with social media and everything. A single sentence can reach millions of people a lot quicker than it could before, outside of a primetime address by the president or mm-hmm. something like that. I think I think that's why it's even more important these days for the media to sort of debunk things as quickly as possible so they don't get spread around or amplified, as you say. And also just for we, the informed citizenry of the world, to try and increase our collective science literacy. And this isn't, exclusive to science, of course, but so that we do sort of require evidence whenever possible. And again, all those things, I think, can help tamp down that amplification that the modern media environment allows.
And the science literacy is very useful, and it'd be nice if everyone learned science, but what you show us here is that you don't really have to learn all of the scientific details. You can find them, you can look into it, but you can watch patterns. And one that I'm particularly fond of in your category of the literal nitpick, you said, "Look carefully at the word choice. Who threw the baseball?" You said, and I've noticed that myself. And I've become keen at hearing political prevarication. People who slip around something, use a little too much passive voice, don't quite say something, choose one word over here instead of some more specific word or a more general word. And so you could do it. Maybe it's a postmodern viewpoint, but you can do a lot of textual analysis and see what's going on too, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. That one's an interesting one, the literal nitpick, just because, I mean, in some ways it might be among the most broad, right? Because a good politician is always choosing his or her words extremely carefully, right? And is always going to use that careful word choice as sort of a shield against criticism, maybe. When it comes to scientific issues, there's a lot of room for that sort of trick, right? I mean, there's so much complexity to any of the scientific issues facing the government, like, you know, anything from climate change to public health issues to any of it, really, that you know, there's a lot of room to mess with the specific word choice you have. Mm-hmm. One of the examples in that chapter that I talked about is Senator James Inhofe and fracking, yeah, which is actually one of my favorites in the book, I think, just because it's so silly. I mean, he loves to talk about how there's been no example of contamination of water due to fracking, so hydraulic fracturing for natural gas. And if you're very, very picky about words, then he's probably right. Because the actual act of fracturing rocks deep underground has probably not directly contaminated a water supply. So it can, I mean, and I remember I was working on this when I was at Fact Check, and his staff kept sort of fighting back against me when I would ask for comment, like basically saying that he's right. And I would say, well, okay, but they spilled fracking fluid at the surface, and why would you have that if you weren't going to frack? So, you know, it just none of it follows beyond even just a very quick reading, but it's still a very easy technique to use and pretty insidious.
Well, and our neuroscience people tell us that sort of once that cat has leapt out of the bag, the corrections don't do nearly as much good. I've been seeing this on Perry Mason, these wily lawyers who ask the questions and then there's an objection, they say, oh, I'll retract it. Yeah, a lot of good that was going to do. It makes me think of Paul Ryan and his statement that nobody has ever died from lack of health insurance. But perhaps lack of health insurance is not a disease that actually kills people, but really.
Right, just because you don't list it as the cause of death on the death certificate, it doesn't mean it didn't have an effect, right?
And not every chapter, but the majority of chapters all mention climate change, right? So this, I don't know, what did you feel about this in your life?
Well,
I'm going to have to bring this up again.
Right. Yeah, no, I tried to spread them out a little bit. I mean, I think I had a number somewhere of how many of the 25 or 30 examples were climate. I think it's about half. That are about climate change. I think that sort of works. I mean, that's probably the biggest scientific issue facing the government today. And it's certainly the one that politicians talk about most. Mm-hmm. And it's also one that politicians get wrong most. when I was collecting these sorts of patterns at Fact Check, most of what I was writing about there were comments about climate. So I think that's just sort of a reflection of what is the major scientific issue facing the government today. You know, if I had done this 30 years ago, it might have been about acid rain or something like that. But
that's right. I worked in a lab that, you know, one of the graduate students was working on acid rain. So I was like, oh yeah, wow, brings back memories. So, and actually, I'm just going to take a moment here. When I read your book and I saw in the oversimplification chapter you talked about the University of Alabama, Huntsville data that was about climate that was not entirely accurate, and then how a company in California, RSS Remote Sensing Systems, the head guy over there was really, you know, brought up, no, that's not right, and that it became a big thing. And I was just sort of excited because my oldest son actually works there as a climate scientist now. And it's just such a small little company, 9 people, but it's had a big impact.
Absolutely.
You know, there's one of the debate.
Yeah, theirs is one of the main data sets for satellite-based measurement of climate change. So, yeah, that's a it's a cool company. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. And I was just like, hey, I know that company. More because I honestly hadn't heard of it until, because I wasn't following climate stuff at that time mm-hmm. so closely. So I hadn't really heard of it till my son started working there. I was like, oh, all right. So it's in there. It's pretty cool. So I was looking, other topics that have come up. I mean, you could almost any area of science, but the ones we are used to hearing about science, politicians really mangling, that's an excellent word, things like abortion restrictions, marijuana use, vaccines, so the list goes on and on. Fracking, of course, pollution. I'm just looking, bird flu. Like general health issues related to illegal aliens. I mean, you cover just about everything.
Well, yeah, I tried to give sort of a representative sample. I wanted to make it clear that, I mean, these techniques that I talk about generally are not specific to a certain scientific topic or field or anything. You could use them for pretty much anything. I guess the one exception to that might be the demonizer, which is pretty much specific to immigration, connecting immigrants with diseases that and doing so poorly and wrongly. But that one is sort of specific. The others are all pretty much available for use on whatever scientific topic you happen to feel like getting wrong that day. I tried to sort of take a tour through all the scientific issues that government has to address, which is, pretty much everything at one point or another.
And I am shocked. I shouldn't say I'm shocked. Your book really drove home just how many doctor/politicians are really bad at science. At least when they open their mouth and talk about it to the public.
Yeah, that, I always get a little bit. It sort of angers me anytime a politician gets science wrong, since they're what they're doing is so important to all of our lives. But yeah, it's certainly sort of an extra layer of infuriating when someone who is trained in medicine or science actually still gets it wrong. We actually only have right now one science PhD in all of Congress, Bill mm-hmm. Foster of Illinois, who I've right. got to interview a few times. He's a very interesting guy. But we do have a bunch more MDs, so only the one PhD, but a bunch of MDs who also clearly have plenty of scientific training. And yeah, they get things wrong all the time, whether by accident or not, but they certainly get it wrong. And Rand Paul is in the book a few times, senator from Kentucky, and he is an ophthalmologist, or ophthalmic surgeon, I guess.
Okay.
And yeah, he was responsible for one of my, favorite is the wrong word, least favorite? I'm not sure how to describe it. I get asked sometimes, which of these errors do you like the most? But I don't think that's quite the right question. But the one called the ridicule and dismiss really sort of hurts my soul the most, I guess, because it's this technique to sort of undermine faith in basic scientific research, which really feels so damaging to me. He's been guilty of that. The idea basically is you describe some bit of basic science in completely silly sounding terms to make it seem ridiculous that we would ever fund something like that. It's always about funding, right?
Right.
But that goes way back to the Golden Fleece Awards that I remember from, the 70s and the 80s, when you read the titles of research proposals, and they're always for specific reasons to lead to general things, but they always sound ridiculous.
Sure, yeah. And yeah, that was William Proxmire gave those awards out, who was a Democrat, by the way. But but yeah, after him, Tom Coburn's Waste Book did some of the same stuff. Mm-hmm. Always just finding a silly way to describe something. And it's such a misunderstanding of how basic scientific research works. Not every study that the NIH funds is going to cure cancer. You have to fund as much of this basic research as you can. And over years and decades, it builds on itself until you have some usable answer. And for someone who has an MD to not understand that and to attack funding from NIH, it really gets to me.
It seems at least disingenuous.
Yes, for sure.
And I was noticing you bring up that chapter and that one of the examples is about the fruit fly, you know, the fruit fly research. And I was like, oh, I'm like, oh, fruit fly, I know this is going to be about Sarah Palin. No, it was not. I was like, oh, he didn't even bring up Sarah Palin, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of these, you could probably find similar examples from other politicians. So, but yeah, I think that one, the fruit fly example, which Rand Paul talked about, might have actually come from Tom Coburn's Waste book originally. Mm. So these, as we were talking about earlier, you know, some of these things get recycled and amplified and restated in various ways over the years. So it sort of gets thrown around a lot, maybe.
Right. And just the general ignorance of fruit flies as an important biological model. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, basically is not a sin to not know that.
Sure, sure.
But there is a reason.
Politicians should be a little more informed before they speak up. So there was, I forget which one it was, something with Chris Christie and marijuana. And he seemed to be really in love with this gateway drug stuff. And I think he also brought up he appeared a couple times in the book.
He's in there a couple times, but yeah, sorry.
But I thought, why... You know, who's feeding him information? Like, I just do not imagine Chris Christie taking time on the internet. Maybe he is, you know. I don't know, you know, but do most of these politicians have some sort of advisor? I mean, what do you know about that? I know nothing about that.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, your average politician, governor, congressman, senator, et cetera, will not certainly have a science advisor the way that the president, well, usually
supposed
does.
To.
Yeah. But they certainly have plenty of advisors who are doing the research for them on any topic, scientific or otherwise. I would imagine that something like that, where Chris Christie seems obsessed with the idea that marijuana is a gateway drug in spite of plenty of research to the contrary, or at least muddying the water a little bit. I would imagine that, you know, he has advisors who helped him find some bit of research to support an ideology. I think a lot of times it's backwards. I think they look for things that'll support the agenda they've already decided on. Mm-hmm. Something like, you know, marijuana being a gateway drug. I mean, people, you know, a lot of politicians long ago decided to you know, sort of take a stand on the issue of legalization of marijuana or not, or even just medical use for it. And then they try and find ways to support that position. I mean, the quotes that I had from Christie, it's not like he actually had any support for it. He just said it. He just said it's a gateway drug. And yeah. I mean, that's why it's in the chapter, The Oversimplification, because he's boiling down a very complicated topic, which is really hard to actually research well into a single soundbite, which totally misleads anybody who's listening.
It's probably something from his 70s elementary class, you know.
Yeah,
back in the day that they would say, oh, yeah, watch out because it's a gateway drug, right? So that's just sort of, as we know, you know, what you learn or what you believe initially is really hard to undo, as Jeff had mentioned.
Yeah, right? And a lot of times they benefit from something sounding like it should be true. So, I mean, a lot of us have heard that that term, gateway drug, and probably a lot of people aren't exactly aware of what it means sort of from more so from like a medical perspective. But we've all heard the term, and it sounds like it should probably be right, you know. So it's
They've got a word for it, right? So
right. Yeah, it makes it a lot easier to get away with when there's a term that we've all heard that you can just repeat without any evidence. And again, that's sort of the thing I hope people would take away from this is you need evidence. If you're going to make a claim like that, you better be able to back it up.
I think I'm going to go with you that the demonizing aspect of things is maybe the one that hurts the most, because on, you know, a rational day or something, I'm willing to say, hey, these are the scientific facts. I'm a scientist and I understand that the scientific facts alone do not generally constitute the political agenda and what you want to do. There can be other reasons why you might make a decision that isn't necessarily the best one according to science, the way you asked me the question. I can deal with that. Quit quit demonizing the science to reach your political goals by saying it's all wrong and they don't know what they're doing. I'm no scientist, but they're wrong. And so, you know, you start to take it personally after a while.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, I agree. I get I have to stop myself from just, you know, sort of getting angry on behalf of science, which isn't even a person or anything. It's just a thing.
It's a thing, but yeah, but, you know, it's not a bad thing.
Right, right. No, I agree. It starts to sort of grate the more you think about these techniques and things. I mean, I feel like I'm discouraging people from reading the book now, but the more you see it, it compounds and you start to see these things more and more, I think.
Okay, I'm no science journalist, but so I was reading and I wrote this down. I was about at page 94 when I thought of this rhetorical question. Why should anyone believe you in your debunking? I have some things in mind, but go ahead.
Well, yeah, that's a perfectly good question. I am also not a scientist. I have no PhD or particular expertise. And even if I did, I was talking about so many different topics in there. No one's an expert in all these things, right? Right. I think, as I keep saying, you know, everyone should require evidence for claims, and just go to the back of the book and you can find every single citation, every single bit of science I talk about is cited there. So basically, I just am trying to debunk and explain using actual experts and actual expertise from people who do know these things. So, mm-hmm. As I said when we were talking about the oversimplification, sometimes it is useful to be able to explain complicated topics in ways that are not directed only at experts. So I tried to do that, but I also tried to make use of what actual science says, and I tried to cite it as thoroughly as possible. So if anyone wants to check my work, they are more than welcome to.
Checking your work, and I think you and I agree on this now, because I settled on that years ago for myself, that for day-to-day understanding and operations, we sort of use an executive committee of experts. But we can avoid appeal to authority strictly by saying, oh, he's a great scientist. It's like, you know, there's a chance he knows what he's talking about because she's worked on this all of her life with the fruit flies, and there's a good reason for this. But when you boil it all down, it's always felt to me like science, big science, all of it, says, don't take my word for it. It'll take you some effort, but you can do the work and dig as deep as you want and see if what I say is true. And it feels to me like, you know, there's not trying to hide things or to keep it down, but always the welcome, and there you are. You say, here are the things, here are the experts I talked to, here are the experts I read, and you can go and you can learn this for yourself. But it's not always as easy as just listening to what people say in the evening news. That's unfortunate, but there you go. It does take some work to be a good citizen, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I tried also in the book to, for each of the techniques and just generally offer at least a few sort of, you know, tools for how to deal with this, right? Say, okay, you've heard a questionable claim, now what, kind of thing. And as you said, it's not reasonable to expect all of us to suddenly become experts in every topic. I mean, that's, we just can't do that. We don't have the time. We don't have the training. We don't have the expertise. I think the main thing to think about in that sense is like, okay, it's not like I'm telling everyone to go read a peer reviewed journal on, you know, water contamination in the Marcellus shale region or whatever, you know, like, I'm just suggesting that we all sort of increase our base level of skepticism, I guess. And that, if we did that collectively, it just becomes harder, I think. It becomes harder for politicians to sneak the stuff past us, you know?
With a bit of thought, not all that much, and maybe a bit of practice, you can deploy these tools that you give us and start to be like a scientist where not everything is equally interesting to you, perhaps, and requires things, but you can learn how to make questions that get at the root of things, and you can focus on a particular part and check something that's important that's being used in a particularly bad way for some important legislation, say, or something that's important to you. So it's not hopeless. You don't have to throw up your hands. You can learn this, but it does take a bit of thought.
Yeah. No, and one thing I don't think I actually use this phrase in the book, but I've been saying it a lot recently, is that I wish people would understand a bit better that there is what I think of as a hierarchy of sources, that there are, you know, people will say like, well, okay, you're wrong about climate change because I read this one thing that said it's all, you know, it's all wrong or something. But obviously that's ridiculous. I mean, there's a thousand things saying the other. I mean, you know, I do think, again, because people should not be expected to become experts at everything or be able to read necessarily the sort of the top level of that hierarchy, peer reviewed, you know, consistently done in good journals, scientific research. But then, you know, the New York Times is a good source. It probably is going to tell you something, you know, reasonably correct. It doesn't mean they don't get things wrong. Of course they do. But that is a better source than Breitbart. And I don't think that's like a controversial thing to say. You know, I think it is a really important sort of skill for any person to have, to be able to recognize that some sources are more likely to lead you astray than others. And this is not just specific to science, of course, but because science is complicated and tough and sort of covers a wide range of issues that we all, again, are not experts at, I think it's especially important now that we learn just which sources we can trust.
Yeah, that's, you know, an excellent point. And actually, so your book came out in April 2017, and I'm on a team of people who teach a general non-majors biology class twice a year. And your book came out just as the class is nearing the end. Mm-hmm. But one of the things we made an effort to try to teach students, this is where we would like your good answers to come from. This, you know, it shows you thinking about your source a little bit. And I just thought, you know, your book, I recommended it by the end of the class. Now, chances of how many will read it, I don't know. A lot of the students are English as second language, you know, in addition to it not being their major. But I was really trying to push this idea, like, you know, you can, you know, increase your level of skepticism, as you said, and understand where politicians might be trying to pull the wool over your eyes, you know, if you read this book, or, you know, you understand why we are asking you to be a little bit more rigorous in your sources. You know, because it's true, we cannot expect these non-majors to go to, you know, peer-reviewed journals to get their information. But we at least want in their discussions that they are talking about something from something reputable. And so I feel like your book is a good guide to that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I'm gonna try and figure out a way, you know, it's very hard when you want to teach the meats and bones of biology to like go, hey, also read this book. That's not gonna fly, but I want to figure out how to, you know, work that in a little bit more. I'm just curious. So you wrote this book about, you know, the way things are done wrong. How about some good examples where we can all go, yeah, you know, this politician got it right.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And that's bizarrely enough. I mean, I've been, you know, I've done a bunch of sort of, you know, events and interviews about the book. And I don't think anyone has asked me that yet. No one has just said, who does this well? Wow. As a result, I don't have a quick answer off the top of my head. I mean, I know that there are plenty of politicians who are very good science communicators. The first example is, as I mentioned, that one PhD in all of Congress, Bill Foster, is a great example. He explains things very well when he talks about scientific issues. Sheldon Whitehouse, the senator from Rhode Island, is another one I admire in this regard. He has been giving a Senate floor speech about climate change every week for something like 180 weeks in a row now. I forget the number he's up to, but I don't know if people have watched Senate floor speeches. They're kind of hilarious because they sound like this impressive thing, but generally speaking, no other senators are in the room, or like two or three of them are there. So you don't see it on C-SPAN. You know, you just see a guy up there talking, and it looks, you know, very dramatic because it's in the Capitol and everything. But he finds it important just to get it on the record, right? Because that is now in the congressional record. So he's another good example of this. I think I actually think President Obama was an excellent communicator on science, and he loved talking about science. He was a self-described science geek or science nerd. I forget how he said it exactly. He was actually pretty good at explaining things, although I should say he appears in the book a few times, getting things a little bit wrong, which, to be honest, you know, his errors are very nitpicky, I guess. But they are in there, and certainly, I should say, Democrats are not immune to these things. You know, it's not like it's only one party, although I don't think it's a controversial statement to say one party is worse these days than the other when it comes to science. So those are a few examples of specific people who do well. I don't have, you know, a great quote or anything for you that off the top of my head of someone really explaining things well. But those are the people I would say to seek out if you're interested in seeing a politician do well explaining science.
And you had to put in your foreword of the book that you know as you were writing and it was in process, of publishing, there was really not time to write about what's happened with Trump. And it was a really interesting beginning of the book to say, you know, whoops, we did not expect this, and yet here we are.
Yeah.
So in this meantime, your book's been out. We've seen more coming from the White House. What is your assessment? What kind of things are we seeing from there? And actually, I guess Donald Trump may not necessarily fall into any of these specific categories where he's purposely trying to deceive, right?
Well... Yeah, I guess, well, okay, so yeah, I mean, as you said, I got them to include a foreword, which I sort of got in under the publishing schedule wire, just to explain that, yeah, first of all, it's a matter of timing. I was writing before he was sort of relevant, so he's not in there much. But the other reason that he's not in there is that the point of the book is to sort of help people spot and deal with subtle or nuanced ways of misleading us on science, and I don't think subtle and nuanced are words very, you know, well described the president right now. His errors are just not that hard to debunk. When he talks about science, it's ridiculous. You know, there's not much point. It's just wrong. I do think a lot of what he says would fit into the last chapter, the straight up fabrication, where you just make stuff up. Since he has taken office, he has talked about science maybe twice or something. I mean, there was his speech about the Paris Agreement, which was riddled with errors. And he did actually use a few of the things. I think there was probably an example of a certain uncertainty in that speech, if I remember. So he's using them, but he just doesn't talk about science very much. His cabinet, though, does, because some of them, it's their job to do this. So Scott Pruitt at the EPA and Rick Perry at the Department of Energy, and Ryan Zinke at the Department of the Interior, three jobs that are very science heavy and now occupied by very much not scientists. They have said some pretty egregious things that would fall into some of these categories. I think I've decided that the technique that this administration seems to have fallen in love with would be the blind eye to follow up. So the concept there is just that politicians will sometimes seize on a given result or study or report or something that matches up with whatever, you know, their particular agenda on a topic is or something. And then they'll just stick with it, even if the next study or next report contradicts that finding or even just tempers it a little, just changes the result, which happens in science all the time. You know, we learn more as we go. But sometimes politicians will just stick with that first one because that worked a little better for whatever the thing is they're trying to do. Usually, this is subtle because, again, it'll be some peer-reviewed paper that they are citing, so it sounds reasonable. And how are we going to know that there's another peer-reviewed paper that came out 2 years later that changes things a little bit? You know, so it's a tough one. But in the case of this administration, they are ignoring so much science that it's sort of blows my mind. My favorite example, and this is just sort of funny, both Pruitt and Perry, I think, in separate interviews on TV, I think, said some version of carbon dioxide is not the knob that turns the climate. I forget exactly what the phrase was. Basically, CO2 is not the primary driver of warming, which ignores science dating back to 1896, the famous paper by Arrhenius, which described how exactly CO2 could change the world's temperature. And obviously we've improved on that paper since then, but it is literally ignoring more than 100 years of science. And they do this with a lot of things. A lot of the initiatives or studies we're seeing, so for example, the grid study, the electric grid study from the Department of Energy, just ignored a couple of decades of research that has already looked into the question of whether adding solar and wind power to the grid will destabilize it.
Yeah.
And they just decided they were going to do it again because they wanted a different answer. You know, it's a little different than what I talk about in the book, but it seems to fall sort of into that category of just ignoring the inconvenient answers that have already come up. So that was a rambling answer, because there's a lot they're doing. So
sure. So and speaking of people, climate science, people doing the right thing, politicians, how about Al Gore?
I mean, I think Al Gore is generally a pretty good communicator on this stuff. I confess I have not seen the sequel to his movie.
I haven't seen the sequel either.
But I read a couple of good reviews from climate scientists who were assessing the actual science in it. I know that Michael Mann at Penn State wrote a review saying it's basically pretty accurate. I think he had a couple of quibbles, but nothing dramatic. So I think he's a good communicator, and I'm actually pretty fascinated these days on the sort of backlash that he and also that Bill Nye gets when they talk about, I mean, anything really, but climate in particular. It's like this incredible shoot the messenger kind of thing where you see people yell about how these guys are not scientists really, so therefore everything they're saying has to be false, even though again they're just reporting what actual scientists have found. You know, it's very strange. I don't have an answer for why that's happening. It's bizarre to me though.
Ad hominem is always popular when you don't have anything else to do.
I suppose that's true, but it seems somehow amplified with both Al Gore and with Bill Nye that there's an incredible amount of hatred for them. I actually have like a Twitter search I do periodically just for not a scientist, just to see if people are talking about the book or anything, because I'm, you know, vain like that. Mm-hmm. But that search is dominated by people saying Bill Nye is not a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible how many people are just obsessed with that.
Yeah,
and it is true, but he's very popular and very visible. So it's going to take a lot of personal attacks to try to knock him over.
Yeah, no, I see that.
There are whole armies of people waiting to do that.
That's true. Yeah, absolutely.
All it takes is for someone to say. But one of the ways that I shouldn't blame Joanne yet, will, you know, harshly judge sometimes the authors that we read and talk about is the precision of their language. Because in a popular science book or when you're speaking politically, it should be understood that you're not going to be able to cover all the details and just sort of say whatever comes to mind. And so I watch to see whether I feel that people are being careful to represent the science that is part of what they're doing without choosing their words incautiously. I like to see them taking care to choose the words so that they don't say something misleading, which is almost the same thing you would say about people who begin with, "I am not a scientist." And most of the prevarication that I hear is choosing words very carefully in order to mislead. And this is where it's awfully hard to go with the not ascribing intent, because in a lot of these cases, it seems like the wording is very carefully chosen in order to leave a false impression of some sort.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, among the ones that I sort of backed off that intent issue and was willing to ascribe intent, were the butter up and undercut, where you mm-hmm. you know, you talk up a topic and then try and cut its funding. I mean, you clearly have to plan that out. The literal nitpick, sort of what you're saying, I guess, is also one where if you're choosing your words that carefully, it seems very unlikely that you're just randomly getting it wrong by accident, you know.
Although the reason that came to mind is because we're talking about Bill Nye, particularly about mm-hmm. Al Gore. I think Al Gore chooses his words carefully in order to represent the science as accurately and precisely as he can in whatever form he's at, and to try to avoid saying something that's going to make people shoot off in the wrong direction. And that's, I think that's valuable beyond just, you know, a few words or something. That's really an important thing.
Yeah, no, I agree, especially because I think, as you said earlier, you know, it's the first thing you say that will probably carry the most weight, even if someone corrects it afterward. Mm-hmm. So if you're being careful with the science, then you're going to spread the best possible version of something instead of having to try and fix it later. So yeah, no, I agree.
Now, one thing that came to mind while I was reading the section where you were talking about, I guess, last year's campaign and the kerfuffle over the invented videotapes about Planned Parenthood publicity. And the question that came to mind is, do you think there's a line, and where is the line, for when do we hold politicians accountable?
Accountable in what sense?
For propagating lies and saying things that are incorrect.
Right. Well, I mean, ideally the line is nothing incorrect and no lies. In terms of holding them accountable, I mean, is there any mechanism there beyond voting people out of office? I mean,
I don't, except for legal means, but you were talking about Trump, and I was thinking here his administration is a perfect example of we'd like to believe that if people can spot lies and misrepresentations, that they would feel strongly about not doing that. But one thing we've learned during this administration is lies and misrepresentations are fine with a third of the electorate.
Yeah, no, and that is a great point.
So voting people out is not the thing we'd hoped it would be a few years ago.
That's totally true, and I honestly do not have a great answer to that. I got asked that just the other day. You know, how do you respond to someone who says, like, well, I don't care what your experts say, I want to make America great again, or whatever. Like, that's just the only answer they have. Yeah. I have no idea. I mean, it's a really, really tough issue that we're facing, where again, people do not seem to have in their head that some sources are more reliable than others, and that some statements are more reliable than others, and even to care whether or not one of them is a statement is reliable. I do not have a good answer for that, and I don't claim that the book is going to solve that issue or anything right now.
Yes, although one tactic that I've been trying out, and I think I've seen more TV journalists do it, particularly when these science questions come up, mm-hmm. is when the statement that, you know, is, about which one should be skeptical is made, is it used to be common to say, well, that's what he said, let's just leave it and move on. And people should be and seem to be now less inclined just to leave it alone. And I think the tactic is always to say, why? How does that happen? And mm-hmm. ask for the next level. And when they say, well, because this, well, how does that work? You can always penetrate a little further. And these days, I think with the ones who are doing the prevaricating, they don't seem to have very much depth to their misrepresentations. And it doesn't take long sort of to flay off the top layer and see that they're just fabricating the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right. And sort of random bit of welcome changes. You said the interviewers are getting better at that. I also think just that the TV stations are getting better at fact checking on the screen. Mm-hmm. You know, you see those little, the chyron, the crawl at the bottom, that'll just say in parentheses, it wasn't, or what, you know, it's false. Yes. Or whatever. Trump says falsely that something. So, you know, I think that that's actually pretty useful, because again, it's that first time that matters. The first mm-hmm. Quote that you're seeing is going to be the one you remember. So And getting that out there right away.
It's less the technology or having fact checkers than it is having the will to do that.
Yeah.
That has changed.
So I wonder, so this is your first book. Do you think you're going to attempt another one in the future?
Yeah, I'd certainly like to. I don't have anything in particular in the works just yet. I've been sort of batting around some ideas, but and I like, you know, I like the process of writing a book. It's sort of a fun thing to do, and it's a fun process. So I think I will, but it remains to be seen exactly what that will turn out to be. Ideas welcome.
Well, and yeah, I think a follow-up of the whole Trump administration could possibly work.
Yeah,
need more time to see what else happens.
It's too easy. Too
easy. The problem with that also is that things seem to change so quickly. If I propose a book today, it'll probably be wrong tomorrow. So
right. This will be something to take in a reflective stance, right?
Yeah.
When all is said and done, whatever length of time that happens to be, and. It is funny how your book, for me personally, has really got my eyes open for not a scientist. And I don't do a search like you do, because that's, what you need to do for your own promotion and book and all. But I thought it was really funny when Scaramucci had his short-lived tenure at the White House, and something came up where, he was, a climate change believer, I guess, mm-hmm. would be the opposite of a denier. During that time, before he was trying to gain Trump's favor,
right?
He even said, "Well, I'm not a scientist, but And I thought, wow, that's pretty funny. Everybody in politics must get a little training in that to say, "I'm not a scientist."
Well, yeah, I've actually been kind of amazed when we were finishing up the book, and it was still, say, maybe almost a year ago now, that talking point had certainly gone out of vogue, and we're circling back to Jeff, what you were saying earlier about that quote from Obama. I kind of thought mm-hmm. that he had killed the line. He had just killed it. And because, because of the way he said, well, I'm not a scientist either, but I know some good scientists. It's a very mm-hmm. clear refutation of that line. Of course you're not a scientist, but there are good scientists, and we can all talk to them and hear what they have to say. And it did actually die down for a little while. So I was sort of worried, well, the title is now no longer in vogue. And then suddenly it just came back. And it's amazing to me that it came back, because it really is just an incredibly stupid line. And I mentioned in the introduction, there's a Republican consultant and strategist named Mike McKenna, who once mm-hmm. called it the dumbest talking point in the history of mankind. And yet here we are, and we're still hearing politicians use it. It's remarkable.
So actually we have 2 minutes left, and I always want to ask our guests if there's something you wanted to bring up that we didn't bring up, or something you would like to leave our viewers with.
Oh, man. I was not prepared for a closing statement.
Question, right?
It's just an opportunity.
Sure. First of all, thank you very much for having me on to see this. This was a fun conversation.
I'm so glad you wrote this book. I love it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And yeah, I guess I've probably said it a few times already, but all I hope that people might get out of this is that we all should increase our level of skepticism a little bit, and really demand that our elected officials give us reasons for what they're saying, give us evidence for things. That's sort of the overarching message. Even if, as we've talked about, you can't learn every detail about every scientific topic, that's just not a reasonable thing to ask. So yeah, I don't know. I think if we all worked on that a little bit, then we'd probably be a little bit better off.
As we finish, Joanne, there was one last little thing that reading Dave's book, I was fairly late in the book, I was reading about the uncertain certainty, and your quick way of summarizing that was to say, the uncertain certainty says, if we don't know it all, we know nothing. And I can leave it to people that want to read and find out. But while I was reading that, you you brought to mind the idea that scientists, one thing that science does is quantify its uncertainty about something. And I think that's something that else that people can look for, perhaps, is to see it's natural and normal for scientists to say, these are the things we don't know, and this is how much we don't know about it.
Absolutely. It's a comfort with uncertainty that I think is important for people to realize is a constant among scientists in every field. Just that, that it's okay to have a margin of error. You know, every measurement, your thermometer outside has a margin of error. And that doesn't mean you don't know what temperature it is outside. You know, it's so, yeah, that's a really important thing, I think, for people to realize too.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dave, for joining us. I'm really, really, actually, I'm really glad you wrote the book because, first of all, it's very unique, you know, and it was a fun way to present a topic, you know, that has a space reality about, you know, how politicians deal with scientific information. And I feel like that's really, really important. And I enjoyed this book quite a bit. And I'm recommending definitely people, if you have a chance, it's not a difficult read. It's very straightforward and lighthearted. So I highly recommend Not a Scientist by Dave Levitin. Dave, thank you for joining us. Jeff, thanks again.
Always. Thank you to both of you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much,
Dave. Really glad. All right. We'll see you again next time.